Hi, everyone. I'm attorney Donna DiMaggio Berger, and this is Take It to the Board, where we speak condo and HOA. Today, we have our second repeat guest on the podcast. My partner, Howard Pearl, is back again. Howard's episode on enforcing rules and restrictions in community associations remains the most downloaded episode of Take It to the Board. This time, we will be talking about Becker's board member boot camp and how Howard's personal military background inspired this themed board certification training course. If you're a board member on a community association board in Florida, you're going to want to stick around for this entire episode as Howard is going to walk you through the elements of his board certification course. Now, just a little background on Howard. He grew up in Pittsburgh, the eldest of two children, and joined the Army at 17. Since he was still a minor, the Army recruiter went to his parents' house and needed them to sign. He'll tell us in this episode how that went over with his parents. Speaking of his parents, Alex and Evelyn, they owned six toy stores in Pittsburgh. After they moved to Florida in the early 80s, Evelyn and Alex both became community association managers. Evelyn was the manager for the Country Walk Homeowners Association when Hurricane Andrew hit back in 1992. Now, we're taping this episode on August 28th with Hurricane Idalia on her way. Howard also became a community association manager and then achieved the PCAM certification. In the year 2000, he decided to go to law school. And funny enough, he interned at Becker, where he and I embarked on a fruitless project to create a database of arbitration cases. Howard was called up for a tour of duty in Iraq in 2005 in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and he served 3 years of active military service. We're proud to have him at Becker, and I'm delighted to have him back on the podcast. So, Howard, welcome back to Take It to the Board.
Thank you, Donna. That was nice words, so I appreciate those.
So, as I said in the introduction, your podcast episode on enforcing rules and regulations, it remains the most downloaded episode of the podcast. Why do you think that topic resonated so deeply with our audience?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's what most boards have to deal with most of the time, is enforcing rules and regulations. And it's not a very easy issue to navigate. It's a very difficult issue to navigate. And not only do you have to take into account common sense, but there's a lot of statutory requirements as well. So I think when you put all those factors together, there's a lot of information for board members to know and understand in regard to enforcing rules and regulations.
So I mentioned your parents. I'm fortunate to have met and know both of your parents. Your father unfortunately passed away. Your mother's still with us. But were rules and regulations a big part of your household growing up?
Well, unlike today, I think rules were a big part of most households for people who grew up in the 60s and 70s like I did. So, yeah, it was. But, you know, it was normal back then. I don't think it's normal today.
Well, but you're the eldest of two. So the eldest, now remember, I'm the third of four. So my parents, you're right, rules were really big in the DiMaggio household. But by the time I came around, and there's a big gap between my two older siblings and me and my younger brother, I think our parents were a little worn out. You were the eldest child, so you probably got the brunt of it as well.
Well, don't forget, Donna, we all know that rules and regulations don't apply to you. That probably started from the get-go for the reasons that you mentioned.
That's not entirely true. And, you know, you can still talk to my parents. They're in Weston, Florida. You can call them up. They would probably agree with you that I was not the most rule-compliant child. So the topic for today, Howard, is Becker's board member boot camp and how your personal military background has inspired this military-themed board certification class. Huh. With that being said, tell us, when did you join and why did you join the Army?
Well, I joined the Army in 1975. Yes, I am that old. I know I don't look it, but yes, I am that old.
You don't look it.
As you said, I was 17 at the time. And I don't know, ever since I was a young child, I was always interested in the military. And I think in the back of my mind, I always wanted to join the military. And as you said, I didn't really discuss it with my parents. I went down to the recruiting station, met with the recruiter, decided I wanted to join, and dragged the recruiter home to meet my mom and dad to sign the papers. And that was the first time they even had a whip.
And how did that go over with Evelyn and Alex?
My parents were always very supportive of whatever I wanted to do, no matter how stupid it may have been at the time. So, of course, they were, you know, they signed off like that.
I'm trying to think, in 75, was there any world event that would have prompted you to join the Army? Like, I know in the aftermath of 9/11, there was a big recruiting bump obviously. Was there anything at that time? Or,
well, if you remember, that was probably only a year or two after the Vietnam War was over. So I figured it was a good time to join. Little did I know, 30 years later, I would maybe second guess that decision.
Well, I've always wondered, does fear play a part when you're evaluating whether or not to join the armed forces?
I think if you're deciding you're going to join the military, you've already been through those conversations in your head. I mean, if you don't think there's a chance you're going to be deployed, maybe not come home, then you shouldn't join in the first place.
So tell us about your basic training.
So again, this is back in 1975 is when I went for basic training. Back then, they still, excuse the expression, beat the heck out of you, and they're able to harass you and do all sorts of things to you that they're not able to do today. So, you know, 17 years old, you go through that stuff and you learn. I actually was trained as an enlisted person. I was a field artillery person. And then I got out after 3 years and joined the reserves and went to ROTC, became commissioned as an officer in field artillery. And a few years later, I went and I got training to become a military intelligence officer. So I was both an artillery officer and a military intelligence officer for the next 30 years that I served in the reserves. So, yeah, it was a good time.
Well, let's take a step back. How memorable was your drill sergeant?
Oh, I still can see their face, Drill Sergeant Gonzalez and Drill Sergeant Polk. So what's that tell you? That I can tell you their names almost 50 years later, and I can see their faces. If they were walking down the street, I would be able to pick them out. Everybody has a very personal relationship with your drill sergeant, and I think for probably anybody who served in the military would tell you the same thing that I just said about their drill sergeants.
Are the military movies the funny ones that I remember seeing, Private Benjamin, Stripes, where they depict the drill sergeant screaming in people's faces, getting them ready for active combat? Is that just Hollywood, or is there a real element of truth to those depictions?
There's an element of truth to those depictions, to some of them. I mean, the screaming in your face, you know, the getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, having 2 minutes to eat your food. I was a little chubby when I went into the Army, so that they would always take the dessert off of my tray and give it to the skinny kid.
Would literally walk up, take your dessert off and give it to somebody else. And you had nothing to say about it.
Every day, three times a day.
I can't picture you, Howard, standing for that. But I guess you had to. There's no option.
No, there's no option.
What if you wanted? What if you were inclined to disobey? What happens?
You either got the heck beat out of you, or you got discharged. One or the other. I mean, you know, they call it military training and basic training, and you know, it is what it is. And you either agree to it or you don't.
you mentioned a lot of training. Did you feel that that your training adequately prepared you for your tour of duty in Iraq?
Well, remember, my initial training was in 1975.
That's true. And
subsequent training, you know, was just in the reserves from, you know, 1980 forward. I will say that the military intelligence training, you know, that's always going to prepare you for what you have to do as a military intelligence officer, which I operated as when I was over in Iraq. But then before you get deployed, they sent me to two months of training. In Indiana, 2 months before you get sent over to Iraq, and then another 2 weeks of acclimatization in Kuwait. So that's really where you got, you know, prepared for whatever you were going to do in Iraq.
Did anything surprise you when you first got there?
The heat. There's nothing like, you know, we all just went through this horrendous heat in South Florida, you know, a couple weeks ago. And I will tell you, it was hotter than that. I'll never forget stepping off the airplane in Kuwait, probably at 11 o'clock at night, and it was 125 degrees outside.
And you're wearing all your gear, too. I mean, that's one thing. You're in the desert, but you're also wearing a bunch of gear.
Yeah, not at that point, but once you're deployed and you're out, yes, you're in that heat with about 50 pounds of gear.
What, 50 pounds of gear?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about the type of gear you had to carry on a daily basis when you were deployed?
Well, you would wear your flak vest, you know, which was basically two steel plates in a vest, one in the front, one in the back. And these were not the plates they have these days that you can buy that are lightweight. These were the real heavy duty, for lack of a better term, pig iron plates that you wore, one in the front, one in the back. So you basically, they were baking you all day. You know, and your regular gear, your rifle, your gas mask, your pistol, your helmet, lots of fun.
You know, I mentioned Private Benjamin and Stripes. In both of those movies, one of the themes is that they get in great shape. Did you get in great shape when you were over there?
You don't have any choice but to get in great shape. Nothing else. The heat will sweat it out of you.
So other than the obvious risks of being injured or killed, what were your significant challenges there?
Well, the most significant challenges, I think, from a military point of view, were staying alert, never letting your guard down. You know, basically, you have to be on 24/7 alert for the 10, 11 months that I was over there. And obviously, however long somebody's deployed, you're on 24/7 alert. And it's very easy to get complacent and not put your helmet on, not put your vest on because you're only going here or you're only going there. And unfortunately, that's when something will happen. So that was significant challenge, just keeping alert. Mm-hmm. And the other significant challenge was communicating with your loved ones back home.
Well, tell me about that. How often could you? What was the method of communication you used?
Look, everybody is different. It depends on where you were stationed. I was stationed at Camp Taji. I was working on the Iraqi side of the base. So they had telephone lines that were available for use, but they were out half of the time and you had to stand in line. So, you know, I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and do my thing so I could get over there and be able to use the phone lines when I was able to. And then occasionally, you know, I actually had a satellite phone that I took with me just for emergencies, personal emergencies, but I would use that every now and then to reach out if I wasn't able.
But if your wife or your parents needed to get in touch with you, were they able to get in touch with you easily?
They could get in touch with you, might take up to 24 hours. Generally, mm-hmm. if there was an emergency, you know, they would have to call the Red Cross. The Red Cross would get in touch with the command and blah, blah, blah. But if somebody, you know, and obviously it happens, you know, soldiers have emergencies at home for whatever reason, people pass or something happens. And it would take about 24 hours for someone to get in touch with you. From home, if they are.
Was one of the challenges, I know you mentioned two challenges so far, but what about your schedule? I mean, did you always know where you were going to be every day of the week, or did your schedule change up depending on what was going on?
What I was doing, I was training Iraqi soldiers, so my schedule was pretty set. Luckily for me, I wasn't knocking on doors, you know, searching for bad guys. But the people that are doing that, you know, their schedule would change every day based on what was going on.
So we have people listening, Howard, that have no understanding of the Operation Iraqi Freedom. What can you tell us about the operation?
Well, the operation was predicated on the fact that, you know, there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and the United States wanted to go in to secure those from Saddam Hussein, as well as, you know, capture Saddam Hussein. And I was called up to support that. That's what we went over for. I will tell you that I personally saw chemical weapons that they weren't supposed to have. So that's what it was.
Howard, there's a picture in your office of you sitting on a throne. Am I correct in assuming that may have been one of Saddam Hussein's thrones?
That is correct. That's exactly what it was. It was one of Saddam Hussein's thrones. When you said that, I thought you were referring maybe to the bathroom or something. Obviously, you weren't.
Now, did you and all your comrades get a chance to take a picture on his throne? I mean, how did that happen? How did that photo op happen?
That is one of his castles that the United States Army used for one of their headquarters. And I was visiting the headquarters for one of my missions. And so that's how that.
That's an amazing story. Well, let me ask you that. I have another question. Can you describe a particularly memorable or impactful moment during your time over in Iraq?
Yeah, obviously there were lots of memorable moments, some good, some not so good. But I will tell you, when I got to my station, I actually went looking to see if they had any Jewish services. And I found out that there were Jewish services held every Friday night at the chaplain's office, led by what they call a Jewish lay leader, who's a regular person who just basically knew the services. Three or four Jews, you know, in Iraq, okay, having services. So the person that led the services left. He got redeployed after about 2 months. So I became the lay leader by default. And I led the services there for the next 8 or 9 months that I was in Iraq. And wow. I found that, you know, that was very fulfilling. Leading services. I had soldiers with their sniper rifles slung on their back while they were sitting there Friday night for an hour doing services. We also had high holiday services, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. The rabbi actually flew in a helicopter with a miniature Torah scroll that he brought. And so we were having services with artillery rounds being shot off in the background. That was another memorable.
I imagine that was memorable. Were you homesick?
Yes. So, I mean, I don't want to say no because my parents and my wife are listening.
That's true. They will be listening. I mean, I imagine that you're homesick, but you also have so much taking up your time when you're over there.
You know, yes, of course you're homesick, but you are so busy while you're there and you're so mission focused. I mean, you're busy from the time you get up, you know, to the time you go to bed, you're busy, your mind is occupied. And so, you know, it's almost like you don't have time to be homesick. If that makes sense.
That does make sense. Listen, you've been out of the service for so long now, Howard, but I imagine that it never really leaves you entirely. So how did your military experience impact your perspectives on life, civilian life?
Well, I think my perspective on life and world is why I joined the military. I think everyone in this great country of ours that we are all privileged to live in, we were lucky to be born in, should either serve in the military or the Peace Corps if they're able. I think everybody that takes advantages, everything this country has to offer, has a duty to give something back.
And I like that message, and I'm glad you're putting that message out there. Were there skills that you learned? I understand that your perspective is what led you to join the Army in the first place. But then after you joined the Army, I imagine you acquired certain skills. Did you bring any of those back to your civilian life? Anything that you took away that the Army gave you in terms of skills?
Yeah, I think, look, you know me pretty well. We've been together a long time. I think you can tell that I have a military background. I think most people that have a military background, you can tell they have a military background just by the way they conduct themselves and the way they do business. And so, you know, I think the military teaches you to evaluate whatever situation you're in, explore your options, and then make a decision. And one of the things that I took away is once you make a decision, stick to it. There's always people who are going to be looking to make you change your mind, question your decision, evaluate the situation, look at your options, make a decision, and stick with it. Otherwise, you'll be flip-flopping, you know, all the time. The other thing that I learned is that, and again, I think this is a very important lesson that a lot of people could learn, your mind and your body are capable of a lot more than you think. To use a Yogi Berra mentality, it's 50% physical and 90% mental.
Explain. That's a really important takeaway. So our minds and bodies are worth more. What stops it?
It's just thinking that you can't do something. You know, I think both the military and, fortunately or unfortunately, law school teaches you that you can do anything you put your mind to. And I think a lot of people give up too easily these days.
This is what I know about you. I know you're loyal, incredibly loyal. I know you're no nonsense. I also know you appreciate chain of command. And so all of those things I know about you, how does that fit in with some of the shenanigans you see in our community associations? You know, you talked about not flip-flopping. I've got to imagine sometimes you shake your head when you see some of the mistakes that some boards make.
Well, it goes back to, I said, evaluating your situation and your options. And the first thing in evaluating your situation is knowing what your responsibilities are. In an association, knowing what your legal requirements are, knowing as a board member what you can't do is just as important as knowing what you can do, okay? And as a board member, you volunteered, nobody forced you to be a board member, you volunteered to serve your community. You therefore have the responsibility to learn how to fulfill that responsibility. And that's why I think a lot of board members fall short. And that's why I think Board Member Boot Camp is such a great program that we put on.
You know, there's a lot of parallels. You're right, between agreeing to serve your country and agreeing to serve your community. Yes, they're worlds apart when it comes to the theater in which you are operating, but there are parallels to be drawn. I'm wondering what you make of some board members, and we see it a lot right now, Howard, with the increasing budgets due to the insurance premiums, due to the safety laws, the requirements for engineering, and now communities that are being told they can't continue to kick the ball down the road when it comes to funding reserves. And you've got some board members who really want to be popular. They really want to be Mr. or Mrs. Nice Guy, and they're not making the decisions that perhaps they have to make to fulfill their fiduciary duty. How do you address that, given your own philosophies on service?
Well, I think you'll agree, Donna, I'm not concerned about being popular with anybody. And as a board member, you know, you're going to be unpopular. The truth of the matter is, in today's community associations, with the insurance increases, with the lack of maintenance over 20 years because everybody's waived reserves, with the milestone inspections that just came upon last year, with the structural integrity reserve study requirements, which just came up last year, you know, board members are going to be raising budgets, astronomical amounts, I hate to say it, for years to come. And if you're worried about being popular, you need to resign. You need to do what's best for the community in face of the unpopularity, in face of the criticism, as long as you're doing what's in the best interest of
us. Well, you kind of answered my next question, Howard, because I wanted to ask you how your service in Iraq kind of influenced your thoughts on, you know, the broader concept of duty and sacrifice. And I think you've touched on it already, that it is a sacrifice to say, I'm going to take time out of my busy day, particularly for people who have jobs, they have families, to serve on the boards. But is there anything you can add in terms of how that service has influenced your personal thoughts on sacrifice and duty?
Well, look, if it was easy, anybody could do it, right? And you know, as a board member, I presume the reason people want to be board members is A, to protect their investment. Let's not, you know, let's be realistic about it. Hey, I got a $500,000 or a $1 million house or unit. I want to make sure that there's no bozos on the board and that my investment is protected. And there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, that's been practiced. But when you make that commitment, make it 100%. Don't just be a board member to say, hey, I'm on the board, so, you know, look at me. I'm looking out for you. Yeah, I attend the meetings every now and then. Sometimes I even vote, but I'm a board member. No, there's, you know, if you're going to make that
commitment,
thank you. If you're going to make that commitment, then yes, there's sacrifices. You got to take the phone calls on the weekend. You got to have, you know, board meetings on a Thursday night or whatever the case may be. You need to attend some training so you know what you're doing. You need to stay on top of the new laws. You know, so those are the commitments that you have to make, or else you shouldn't be a board member.
I agree wholeheartedly. Does it confuse you sometimes when we have boards where no one wants to be the president? So I talked about chain of command. And in our community association, sometimes we run across boards where people will serve, but nobody wants to serve as president. What do you say to those boards?
Well, how about communities where people don't even want to serve on the board?
Oh, that's right? Yeah.
Let alone be president. You know, you have communities where you can't even get a quorum of board members, you know, of candidates to run for the board. And look, I don't want to tell anybody how to run their personal life. Everybody's got their own situation. If you don't have time to be a board member, then I think you made the right decision not to run. Okay. But at the same time, somebody's got to run the community. And the alternative is, if nobody wants to be a board member and one person applies to the court for the appointment of a receiver, the court's going to appoint a receiver, and that receiver will charge you double what a normal, you know, management company, whatever, will charge to run the association. So people don't want to be the president. You know, again, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Maybe they don't feel they have the capability. Maybe they're leaders on the board and not followers. But at the end of the day, somebody has to step
up. Somebody has to step up. You know, the point you just made about the receiver, that's what's happening right now with the Miami-Dade community, the Hammocks. So they had that. This is the community with the largest fraud, and they've got a receiver in. And now they're saying, how do we get the receiver out? Because the budget and the expenses associated with the receiver are turning out to be an economic burden.
I just saw that article last week. I think if I recall the numbers, the receiver estimated $1 million. He could get everything done for $1 million. They're not even through the first year. And there's $2.7 million in receiver. So, yeah, not a good option.
You know, we'll have a conversation. Maybe you'll come back a third time and we'll talk about the concept of these associations being run by volunteer boards, because sometimes I think the concept is in jeopardy altogether.
Different podcasts.
Different episodes.
Stay tuned.
Well, before we turn to the actual board member boot camp segment, I did want to, first of all, I always thank you for your service. It's incredible. Every veteran that has served our country should be thanked, and their families should be proud. I did want to give you an opportunity to discuss how you feel about the way veterans are treated and supported in society today.
Well, I think today veterans are given the love and the respect they deserve by pretty much everyone, except for their own government and the VA and how they're treated with their problems. The government took years and years and years to figure out, recompensation for Agent Orange and burn pit issues. And there's still, things going on from the Iraqi war where our legislature doesn't want to give the commitment to our hurt veterans that they should. And again, I haven't had any experience with VA care, luckily. Mm-hmm. But, I think it's sort of a well-known fact that there's issues with VA care that needs.
I imagine that the VA does lobby in terms of getting more government resources and funding.
I'm sure they do. But, the government would rather spend millions and billions of dollars giving it to other countries than taking care of our own people. Sorry, right, I'll get off my soapbox.
I'm going to allow that. All right, let's turn to board certification. So there's a lot of board certification courses out there. We've got a lot of law firms doing it. Management companies host these things. The state, has board certification classes. Tell us about Becker's Board Member Bootcamp and what makes this training different.
It's simple. What makes our training different is we make it fun, right? Let's be honest. Listening to an attorney or two drone on for 2 or 3 hours about board member stuff is usually pretty boring. All right. Board member boot camp, we make it fun, we make it interactive, we make it enjoyable, and we make it something that the board members will not forget.
And we talked about that. The fact that there's this material, it can be dense, it can be dry. But I also think that the actual training resonates with our target audience. I think people like to feel like they're being put through their paces. Do you agree?
I do agree. And again, remember, these are volunteers, and those that come to these courses, they are showing us, themselves, and their community that they do take the commitment seriously, that they are willing to put in the time to try to figure out the right way to do things. I mean, look, taking 2 to 3 hours out of your day as a volunteer, that's a lot. People are busy. Why do people like board member boot camp? It's something different. I think another thing is people learn things without knowing they're being taught things. Okay. And not only that, the way we put it together, there's a structure. Each module builds upon the previous module. And again, I can't say this enough, because to me, this is the most important thing about board member boot camp. You will have fun. We have fun, so you're going to have fun.
Can we have a drill sergeant screaming at them a little bit?
Maybe not the first time. We don't want any heart attacks or anything out there.
So, Howard, when is Becker's Board Member Boot Camp coming up?
Board Member Boot Camp is Tuesday, November 14th from 10 to 3 at the Signature Grand in Davie, Florida. And I am sure this is going to be the first of many around the state.
All right, we need to talk about ranks a little bit. Actually, I never mentioned your ranks. You were a captain and then promoted to a major, correct?
Correct.
Tell us the ranks. What are the ranks, the military ranks?
So when you're first commissioned, you're second lieutenant, first lieutenant, captain, major, lieutenant colonel, brigadier general, major general, lieutenant general, and then general of the armies, which has only been my career.
Wow, that's a lot. And our recruits, our people who are attending are just our basic recruits, correct?
Oh, they're just privates, absolutely.
Privates first class. So I'm going to be there. You're going to be there. Ken Director's going to be there. How are we going to figure out these ranks?
How are we going to figure out the ranks? I'm going to take the fifth on that.
Do I get to be the general?
Of course you're the general.
So before I let you go, I want to ask two more questions. First is, you kind of touched on the modules, but what are the topics that are going to be covered at the boot camp?
We cover association powers and duties, maintenance of common elements, common areas, board meetings, membership meetings, elections, milestone inspections, structural integrity reserve studies, official records, fining, dispute resolution, finances, budget, reserves, insurance. I mean, all the good stuff. I mean, that sounds like 6 hours to me, not three.
And they get their boxed meals, their MREs, their meals ready to eat. We do a working lunch.
Meals ready to eat. We're going to try to bring in some rain so it can rain inside to give them some realistic training for board member boot camp.
You didn't tell me that. I can't have that with my hair. Okay, so my basic understanding of basic training is that it's a process designed to basically break down the individual to build up the collective, to create a shared sense of purpose. We've talked before, I mean, we've talked a lot about the problems we see in communities, and they're always exacerbated when you have a dysfunctional board. So do you think that periodic training like this can prevent or even repair that level of dysfunction on a board?
Absolutely. I think many board problems, if not most board problems, are self-inflicted, usually because of a lack of knowledge or because of, lack of wanting to do the right thing.
How about ego? How about an ego problem, too?
I didn't want to say that, but yes, ego problems. We mentioned it a little bit at the beginning. The statutes cover so many issues that lay people have no idea about. All right. And not only that, the statutes are being changed and tweaked every year. It seems like every year there's more and more and more. So what a board member learned last year may be changed this year, and it may be changed again next year. So it's critical to have this periodic training, to keep board members up to date. As you're aware, Donna, the statutes require that once you get your board member certification, you don't have to take it again as long as you're on a board. Well, I understand that, again, from a practical point of view, but from a realistic point of view, board members should be trained every year for the reasons that I just stated.
You know, with the safety laws that were passed in the aftermath of Champlain Towers, one of the things we suggested to Florida legislators was that there be some training, if nothing else, just on those pieces, on the milestone inspections and the structural integrity reserve study. And it didn't become part of the law. I think it's unfortunate that it didn't, because you're asking an awful lot of these volunteer boards and their managers to try to meet these deadlines and understand the scope of what's being asked of them.
You know, the other thing I want to point out is for those board members who want to learn and who want to be good board members, who I believe are the vast majority of board members, a little sidetrack here. You know, there was all this legislation last year where they wanted to criminalize this and criminalize that. And you mentioned the hammocks, which was atrocious what happened down there. And there's a few other communities where things like that have happened. But those instances are far, far, far the exception rather than the rule. In my experience, the rule is most board members are good people who want to do the right thing, who are trying to do the right thing. And it takes one or two bad apples in the community to harass them. And just, some of the harassment of these board members is terrible. And unfortunately, it's a reflection of today's society. You know, everybody's real easy to sit behind a keyboard now and just blast away, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's, sending emails about how terrible the board members are. But again, I think most board members are good people who want to do the right thing. There are a lot of resources out there for board members who want to educate themselves. Not only our law firm, we have a plethora of courses that are available online. Other law firms have courses available. The division has courses. The state has courses. So for most board members who want to do the right thing, there's a lot of resources available to you.
Yeah, I have several communities right now where the boards are being harassed by a particular individual in the community. We've tried unsuccessfully to speak to our legislators so they kind of understand that the harassment flows in both directions. And you really can have one person who can tie up an entire community, can increase the legal budget exponentially, who can, you know, even if the manager is dealing with the aftermath of a casualty event like a hurricane, can be using the statute as a weapon in terms of document inspections and other requests. So, yeah, you're right. And I do think there is a disconnect with legislators. It's not just in Florida. It's around the country when they're thinking about crafting community association legislation, they're always thinking about it in terms of the individual rights and sometimes overlooking the fact that the board has to operate and you can have one person that pretty much brings the operation to a standstill.
Yeah, I have a few situations like that myself. You know, one or two people, you know, they file frivolous complaints with the division, they file frivolous lawsuits, they file frivolous bar complaints, they file unreasonable record requests every day, you know, and these poor board members who are good people, like, you know, what can we do?
And you mentioned a few minutes ago that there are a lot of communities where nobody wants to serve on the board. And sometimes this is the result of that because they see what happens sometimes when you do get on that board. Yeah. I did want to ask you about, listen, in your military training, there were a bunch, I'm sure, of operational manuals that you had to follow.
Yes.
What about our associations with governing documents? So you talked about volunteer board members perhaps not fully understanding the statute, but can you speak for a minute or two about volunteer board members having to contend with truly out-of-date, antiquated governing documents?
Well, let's talk about board members having to deal with governing documents in the first place. I mean, you know, Donna, we deal with them every day. And when an association asks a question, we got to go look at that association's documents because, you know, I don't remember from today to yesterday what this document says, what that document
says. You mean you haven't committed everyone's documents to memory?
My name's not Kendra. So, yeah, I mean, you know, so and board members, you know, they need to look at their governing documents, but you know, look, let's be honest. The governing documents are usually written by attorneys. Okay, they're always written by attorneys. And there's a lot of legalese in there. And they're not always that easy to understand. So, you know, this is another reason for some of these basic training, like board member boot camp, because we try to cut through the legalese, get to the chase, tell you what you really need to know from a practical day-to-day basis. Instead of you having to go look at Article 7, Paragraph D, Subparagraph 2E that says blah, 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 blah. That's why these courses are important. I think that's why they resonate with the clients.
So, Major Pearl, any final thoughts for our listeners?
The only final thoughts I would say is, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you for the kind words. And all I can say is, if you haven't been to a board member boot camp, you don't know what fun you're missing. Sign up once the invitations go out.
We want you.
We want you.
Thanks, Howard.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to follow and rate us on your favorite podcast platform or visit takeittotheboard.com for more ways to connect.